In our historical survey up to this point, we have overviewed the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC, the Babylonians having taken it under Nebuchadnezzar, and then the Babylonians themselves having been taken over in 539 by the Persians. This began a rule of Persian emperors that lasted all the way down until Alexander the Great in 331 BC when he took over the Persian Empire. For maps, in the notes, you can see the extent of this Persian Empire. And we must keep in mind that the Persians were generally very favorable to the Jews. There was a good relationship between the Persians and the Jews. Remember now, we're calling them Jews because that's what the Scripture calls them following the exile. It's sort of a short form for those of the tribe of Judah. And as far as identification and a distinct entity was concerned, the tribe of Judah was the only one that they could really point to and knew where the people were. So those in exile in Babylon were basically those of the tribe of Judah, and therefore they're called Jews. Descendants of Abraham, as we call them, were scattered all over the Middle East by this time, and within a few centuries they were scattered on up into Europe and elsewhere. And this was the beginning of diaspora. Now, Ezra records for us the two returns, or at least two returns of the people back from the Persian center. Actually, it was back from near Babylon, the city of Babylon, but this was now taken over by Persia. So we've got two returns. The first was the big one under Zerubbabel, and as we have seen, that included almost 48,000 people. And then the second return under Ezra, which was some 60 years later, and that return included only about 2,000. So obviously Ezra is writing after all of these events. Ezra is obviously writing in his own period of time, and he is down in the 458 period of time. That was 458, 457. So this is some 80 years after the first return and about 58 years after the completion of the temple in 516 B.C. So just keep in mind his vantage point, where he's coming from, where he's writing. By the time Ezra writes this, we have had the return under Zerubbabel, we've had the building of the temple and its dedication in 516, we have had the book of Esther. We've had the book of Esther, all of the events of Esther. And by the time we get down to Ezra's point of history, the Old Testament is almost coming to a close. We've had the prophecies of, obviously, of Daniel and Ezekiel, because that was during the exile. We've had the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. There's only one historical book yet to come, and there's only one prophetic book yet to come. The historical book yet to come is Nehemiah, and that takes place very quickly after it, because it's 444 B.C. As opposed to 458 B.C. So you're only just a few years in between. There's only Nehemiah yet to come, and there's only Malachi yet to come of the prophets. And I think I've mentioned before that Nehemiah records the last period of time in the Old Testament, even after Malachi. Malachi is the last writing prophet, but the teaching of Malachi, the ministry of Malachi, takes place within the period recorded in the last chapters of Nehemiah. So as we look at the historical events in Ezra, I want you to be on the alert, on the lookout, to try to judge what kind of a character Ezra was. He is one of the liveliest, most interesting people in the Old Testament. And I want you to see how he had a very great sense of the holiness of God. This is one of the things that comes through. He has a great sense of the holiness of God. And he, with that, has a sense of the holiness of God's people. The two go together. A sense of the holiness of God and a sense of the holiness of God's people. put in New Testament terms, our love for God is reflected by our love for in our love for people. Our vertical relationship is reflected in our horizontal relationships. People that aren't right with God have an awful problem getting along with other people. People who have a smooth, easy, comfortable, happy, good relationship with God have minimal problems with people. In fact, it comes to the zero point. Now, the dimension to that formula, the dimension that I see in Ezra is that he respects the holiness of God, and so he's very concerned about the separateness, the holiness, the set-apartness of God's people, that they're special people. And he treats them with great respect. And when they get things fouled up in their lives, he's very concerned about them. Now, right in this, I think, is a real model for us as to how we view other people. I guess the worst end of this spectrum would be for us to look on a brother or sister who sins or who's misbehaving or thinking or acting or talking in a way unbecoming to the Lord. Our first reaction would be is, well, I thank thee, Lord, that I'm not as that person. I thank thee, boy, that guy's really immature. You know, he's really got to get it together. And his life really isn't counting for anything. And I'm sure glad that I don't do that kind of thing and so on. That's the easy way. Ezra would never do that. Ezra's reaction was, hey, fella, we serve a holy God. Be ye holy too. Listen, the kind of God we serve should make a difference in your life. And so his standard was the holiness of God and the need to conform to that in our lives. Now, the climaxing illustration of this, of course, is in the last chapters of the book where he gets everything set up. The temple has been beautified, has been sort of renovated and restored from having fallen into a bit of disrepair. He calls it beautified, the temple. And the sacrifices are going on, and everything's settled down, and everything looks just perfect. And somebody comes in and says, do you know that the people are going, that some of the God's people are going and marrying the people of the land just like they used to do in the back in the book of Judges? And he almost has a heart attack. It just throws him right in his face that this would happen. So I want you to be conscious of the characteristics of Ezra. Another thing that makes him very, very personal to us, not only theological, we might say, but very personal to us, is the freshness with which he talks about himself. He's uncomplicated. He's almost naive in the best sense. He calls himself four or five times, I'm Ezra, the ready scribe. And he uses the first person more than most of the writers. He says, I told him to do this. And I said to my people, you should do this. And I talked to that man and I told him this. And this is what I said, you know. He's animated. That's the word I'm looking for. He's an animated person. He's a lively person. He's an involved person. He really cares. He gets excited about things. And one beautiful thing about him is that as a leader, he's willing to take responsibility for the people. There is nothing more deadly and fruitless and frustrating than a person who has a leadership office, whether it's pastor or teacher or whatever, who is not willing to take personal spiritual responsibility for other people. And he does. He just watches all his gauges there in the cockpit to see, you know, if there's pressure on this side or they're tipping this way or there's too much heat here or too much cold here. He's just watching the whole thing. And Ezra is a very, very wonderful person from all of these standpoints. Now, just serving the book of Ezra, as you see in the blocked out outline, the first six chapters record the return under Zerubbabel. And I would draw your attention, you don't have to look at it now, but I draw your attention to a footnote at the bottom of page 393 of Leon Wood. Leon Wood points out there that this man named Sheshbazzar, who is mentioned in 1:8, may not be the same as Zerubbabel. It's usually assumed that Sheshbazzar was the same as Zerubbabel. But in this footnote, he says it's quite possible that he was another person and that he actually led the people to the land, but it was Zerubbabel that was the leader that followed him immediately. In other words, Sheshbazzar was just in it briefly. Well, you read the footnote on page 393, just so you're up on that. I have referred to this person as Zerubbabel. It may well be Zerubbabel with another name of Sheshbazzar, but on the other hand, it is possible that Sheshbazzar may be another person. But I just want you to know that I know about that footnote, but I'm calling it Zerubbabel, whatever. Because Zerubbabel, as Zerubbabel, did most of the work involved. Zerubbabel was a civil governor. In other words, he was the civil leader. He was the leader of the person in the people in everything except their religious experience. Now, if there had been a monarchy, he would have been the king. But you see that Zedekiah was the last king. This is the times of the Gentiles. They don't have any kings. So Zerubbabel is what we might call a surrogate monarch. He's not king. He wasn't crowned. But he is fulfilling the role of the civil leader. The very interesting passage in the last two or three verses of the book of Haggai, in which Zerubbabel is called a signet. Have you noticed that verse? Zerubbabel is called a signet. And the reason is that the word signet means a token. A token. An evidence. Just as in a signet ring that a king would impress in a seal, that's the evidence that it's the king sending the letter. It's a token that that is royal. Now, the interesting thing about Zerubbabel is that he is of the line of David. He is of the line of David. And the reason that he is a token, according to Haggai, is that by having Zerubbabel of the line of David lead the people, the people are assured and reminded that God has not forgotten the Davidic covenant. The fact that he wasn't crowned king does not take away from the fact that God has remembered the Davidic line. Zerubbabel then becomes himself, as the leader, a token, a reminder, a validation, an evidence of the fact that God has not forsaken the Davidic line. The other thing to notice is that the high priest was Joshua, obviously no relation to our other Joshua. But Joshua, of course the verb means Savior, Yeshua. Joshua is the high priest. And the functions of leadership are now divided. There is the high priest and there is Zerubbabel. And one is the civil leader, the other is the religious leader. And these are the people that the men that lead the people back in this first return. All right, then turning to chapter 1, we find the quotation here in these first few verses that exactly parallels the last couple of verses of 2 Chronicles. I don't know of a place in Scripture where two books are spliced together more specifically, because 2 Chronicles ends with this decree of Cyrus, and the book of Ezra begins with the decree of Cyrus. I think it's interesting that 2 Kings ends with a deportation to Babylon. 2 Chronicles, which was written many years later, ends not with a deportation to Babylon, but rather the decree of Cyrus, the new king, the Persian king, to send them back to Palestine. So it ends on a high note, we might say. 2 Chronicles ends on a high note, and Ezra 1 begins on a high note. Here's a new age, a new beginning. They're able to go back to the land. And just think of what it meant for these people to be able to go back to the land. They've been for some 70 years, for some of them, out of their land. So in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, and that's referring to Jeremiah 25 concerning that 70 years, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation. Notice, the Lord stirs him up. God intervenes. We've seen intervention by God in Nebuchadnezzar's life. Before that, in the life of the Assyrians, and now in the life of Cyrus. And Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. He knew more theology than Pharaoh, didn't he? And he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. What an encouragement that would have been. And he says, who is of among you all of his people? Well, he says, as God be with him, go back to Jerusalem and build this, and whoever is there should join you, and I'm going to give you safe conduct, and I want you to go back and do it. So in the first four verses of chapter 1, we have the decree of Cyrus. Things are getting going. This is probably about 538 B.C., and the stage is set for them to go back. And then in the rest of the chapter, you've got the preparation for the return. The mention there of the chief of the fathers of Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin is mentioned because Benjamin had been also absorbed pretty well by Judah. You remember how close it was to Judah. And actually, the city of Jerusalem was in the tribal land of Benjamin. So you can see how all of these came together. And the Levites, with all them whose spirit God had raised up to go back and build them a house back in Jerusalem. And then in verse 7, Cyrus brings out all of the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. What a reversal of 586 this was. These gold vessels. I've mentioned before that Cyrus's policy was to appease the gods of the people he conquered. And with other people, he could simply say, hey, take your gods and go home. But with the Jews, he couldn't say, take your gods and go home. That's how they got there in the first place, is because they had carved gods. And fortunately, they left all those back in Palestine, and one of the great things they learned was not to be idol worshippers with a vengeance. But they had these various things to take back. And so they're going to bring them from Babylon onto Jerusalem. Now in chapter 2, we have the list of the people that went back, and that occupies virtually all of chapter 2. So chapter 1 is the decree and the preparation for the return. Chapter 2 is the listing of the people that will be going back. Not all of them, of course, but the leaders of them. Now, why do you think this long list is in chapter 2? Of what value is that? Show them what? It showed the line, yes, it showed the priestly lines, and it showed that they hadn't been lost over there to God, that God knew who they were. And it was important that after they'd been, for the first time in history since they were a nation, out of the land, that they were still known to God. They're identifiable. They're identifiable. Their names were still known to God. And then in the end of the chapter, beautiful verse 69, they gave after their ability unto the treasure of the work. So the priests and the Levites and some of the people and the singers and so on, they dwelt in their cities and all Jerusalem in their cities. And what you have there is a preview of what's going to happen. In other words, this is saying, this is what's going to happen. This is how we're going to get, this is where we're going to get to. Now in chapter 3, as they get to the cities of Palestine, actually of Judah, there are some problems. Chapter 3, they're in the land. They get to the land at the end of chapter 2. We're not given any details about the travel, although we are with Ezra's return, but not with this first one. And the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. There weren't all that many of the people, and so 48,000 people wasn't many to get in Jerusalem, but it was still a pretty broken down place. And Joshua, the son of Jozadak, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, this was the priest and the governor, they built an altar, and fear fell upon them because of the people of the countries round about, verse 3. Notice the contrast between this and Joshua's entrance into the land. When Joshua came into the land with 2.5 million people, the walls of Jericho fell down and they marched through in conquest. Now you've got a little minority of people, a little band of ragtag people that have come back to the land after all these years, only 48,000 of them. And they get back in Jerusalem, and they only occupy just a few square miles around Jerusalem, and they're afraid of the people around. It's quite a different scene. It's a very humbling scene. In Jerusalem, the first thing they did, of course, was this altar to worship God. That was the key to it all. Then the Feast of Tabernacles. They hadn't done that for a while. And notice in verse 6, the first day of the seventh month was the Feast of Trumpets, but there was something missing. They celebrated, an offering on the altar. They had the Feast of Tabernacles preceded by the Feast of Trumpets, But they looked around and they remember that the last time they'd had the Feast of Trumpets, the last time they'd had the Feast of Tabernacles, they'd had a temple there. And it must have been a very, very scary scene to be doing all this out in the open without a temple, without walls, with all the buildings just broken down stone. And so they're very concerned about this. And in verse 8, in the second year of their coming, they began to lay the foundation for the temple and to set forth the work of the house of the Lord here at the end of verse 8. And so Joshua gathered the people together. In verse 10, they laid the foundation of the temple. It was really a big event if you didn't compare it with what had happened before. If you didn't know the Temple of Solomon, it was a wonderful day when they came back from exile 700 miles away and came back from Babylon, came back to the city they thought came back to Jerusalem from Babylon, to a city they never thought they'd see before, the city of David the great king. And we're back here and we have an altar and we're going to lay out the foundation for a temple. And the people that had never seen the temple thought, this is the greatest thing on earth. We never thought we'd ever be back in the land. And the next generation said, had never seen this place, and they thought it was great. But the old generation, they took one look at it, and it was worse than nothing. They said, we've seen the temple of Solomon, you know. We've seen Solomon's temple. And can't you imagine the conversation that goes on? They say, hey, listen, you think this is good? Listen, over there, there used to be a great porch of golden columns, and down here there used to be this, and over here there was this, and I remember when we brought in all the sacrifices, and the choir used to sing, oh, the good old days. Well, each had a point, and I guess this is how it's always going to be in history. You'll have the two generations there together, and for the old generation, nothing as good as it used to be. For the new generation, they haven't seen the old generation. They haven't seen the old things, and they don't have anything to compare it by. So there's a little bit of psychology here, a little bit of human interest in the thing. And as a matter of fact, it comes out in what they did. In verse 13, it says, the noise of the weeping and the noise of the shouting was going on, and you couldn't tell which was which. And if you came up from the outside and said, hey, these people happy or sad? You say, I don't know. They're both. Some of them are yelling their heads off for joy and jumping up and down and raising their hands in the air and rejoicing. And the rest of them are sitting around with their Kleenex out, mopping their faces, you know, their heads between their knees. So this was quite an emotional moment that the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. They didn't know that it was going to be another long period of time before this actually got to be dedicated. It was going to be stopped. Well, adversaries come. Chapter 4, I guess in your outline, chapters 3 to 6 is really the building of the temple. And chapter 4, they get started on it, and some adversaries come down. These are actually the Samaritans. The Samaritans come down. And the problem here is not so much that they wanted to help, was the fact that they thought they owned the land. Now, this is the first confrontation with the people who had occupied the land. The first confrontation with the people who had occupied the land during the exile. And look at it from the Samaritan standpoint. They come down and say, who are these guys coming over here to build their temple again? And, of course, some of them would have remembered the temple, and some of them would have remembered the good old days. And they saw them as a threat. Well, they're going to join them. They're going to help them. And Zerubbabel and Joshua say, you have nothing to do with us to build an house unto our God. And by the way, the Samaritans never forgot this. Because one day there was a rabbi came from Jerusalem on up to a well in Samaria. And he got talking to a Samaritan woman. And she said, we worship in these mountains, in this mountain, Mount Gerizim. You worship down in Jerusalem. They never forgot the situation. As a matter of fact, it was aggravated because in the period before Jesus met her at the well, about 150 years before that, about 160 years before that, the Jews had destroyed a temple, actually there, a worship center up on Mount Gerizim. So there was tension, and this is the beginning of the tension between the Jews and Samaritans. You can trace John 4 right back to this scene, right back here. Yes, ma'am. Good question. Were the Samaritans not a mixture of the Jews? And if so, then what was the big problem? It was worse than not being Jews at all, because the Jews that were mixed in with these other people were Jews from the northern kingdom who had been into idolatry and who were looked down upon by the tribe of Judah. They had been sort of antagonists before they had been taken off into captivity. Then for them to mix with the people of the land and intermarry with them was a black mark against them. And then compound that with the fact that this was of the tribe of Judah, the royal line coming back, you can see how there would be this tension. Plus the fact that they were not worshiping God, and the Jews that came back from Babylon to Judah were theologically very correct. I haven't mentioned it yet to emphasize it, but they never ever went into idolatry again. They did some intermarriage briefly, but they never went into idolatry. And there's one thing they got washed out of their veins in exile was, there is only one God and we don't worship any other God. And when Jesus Christ came along and said, I am God, they said, oh, we can't worship you because that's how we got in trouble before. You're a second God. We only worship Jehovah. and they used their theology in the wrong sense there. So I'm answering your question as to why they looked down on the Samaritans. The Samaritans had another worship center and so on. So the fact that there was a little bit of Jewish blood in these Samaritans, if anything, made it worse. All right, they start to build this, and there's a lot of pressure comes on them, and they eventually have to stop it. Now let me discuss a critical problem here of the text. From verses 6 to 23, we have a parenthesis in the text. In other words, the action which is recorded in Ezra chapter 4, beginning at verse 6 and running through to verse 24, is a parenthesis. It does not record the action that takes place at that spot. And the reason it is put in there is that it records a series of oppositions by neighboring people over a period of years between that time of 536 B.C., between that time and the time of Ezra. So it's as though you are writing about a certain event, and then you take off on a little footnote, and you're writing a 100 years after the event, and you give illustrations of that same kind of thing that's happened between the time of the action and the time that you live. Now, this was a very important kind of action. This was opposition to the Jews building the city, building the wall, building the temple. And Ezra's point here is that wasn't the only time that it happened. Remember now, he's writing a couple of generations later. He's recording this. He's not on the spot seeing this. And he's saying when that happened, when the Samaritans tried to stop the building of the temple then, in 536, that wasn't the last time. For instance, and then he goes through and gives several instances through history right up to his own time in which this has happened. And then in verse 24, you get back on track and you pick up the action, verse 24, that follows right after verse 5. Now, there's a good note on this in Archer, in the new edition of Archer, page 416. Some critics have used this as an indication that Ezra didn't write this at the time that he was alleged to have written it. But I'm just going to read you the paragraph out of here. It says, a careful study of the chapter reveals that verses 5 to 23, I disagree with Archer in the 5 to 23, and so do other commentators. It actually is 6 to 23, but it's okay. Constitute a long parenthesis dealing not with the building of the temple, but rather with the erection of the walls of the city. This material, that is from 6 to 24, the 23, this material is introduced at this point simply to indicate the malignity of Judah's adversaries. We are not to understand the opposition of Rehum and Shimshai as arising in the 520s, but rather in the late 460s. That's 80 years later. 60 years later. Early in the reign of Artaxerxes I. in 424, the narrative is brought back to the point at which verse 4, had left it, that is, at the time when the temple had not yet been built. In other words, we are not to understand Ezra's purpose here as a strictly chronological account, but rather a history of the opposition to the building of the city walls from the time of Cyrus to the reign of Artaxerxes. He follows a topical order rather than chronological, etc. So if you want to read more about that and maybe include some of it in your notes for further reference, it's 416 in Archer. I don't think we have to take time on that passage. It's important, but Artaxerxes, of course, is Artaxerxes Longimanus, who reigned sometime afterwards. So Ahasuerus is Xerxes. You'll find a listing of these five key kings of Persia in Leon Wood and a note about each of them. And I would encourage you to get a hold of each of them: Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius Hystaspes, Xerxes the First, and Ahasuerus. It's not all that difficult. Just briefly, in a word, what happened was that Cyrus was an excellent ruler. He died in 530 B.C. His son came to the throne. His son was a good ruler too, but his son had a brother. In other words, there were two boys. And the name of the second one was Smerdis. And with a name like that, he had to be good. And the one that inherited the throne, who was actually Cambyses, killed Smerdis because he was afraid that while he was away on some military expedition, that Smerdis might take over. They could have a palace coup, so he killed him. But the story goes that he killed him secretly, and that nobody knew he was dead. And then Cambyses goes off on some trips, and he goes all the way down, and he actually conquers Egypt. And Cambyses is the one that stopped the building of the temple. He's the one that stopped it in 536. So as long as Cambyses is on the throne, the foundation just sits there. And that, he comes on the throne in 536 B.C. Then 530 B.C., he comes on the throne. But they actually stopped it a bit before that. Well, as he is down in Egypt, he conquers Egypt, he comes on his way back up toward Persia again. He's coming home from his expedition in 522 B.C. And as he gets to Mount Carmel, remember when Elijah the prophet's of Baal, where he gets to Mount Carmel, he gets a message. And the message says that a certain person, a general, has killed your brother, or has taken over the throne back there, and he is purporting to be this other brother, and he's called Pseudo-Smerdis. As Pseudo-Smerdis has tried to take over there, but he wasn't the real Smerdis was been dead, but nobody knew he was dead. This is how there are several versions of this story, but this one very interesting version. And for some unknown reason, Cambyses commits suicide on Mount Carmel. And so this other person now takes charge, and he is Darius Hystaspes. And he's a great ruler. He's Darius the Great. And he rules from 422 to 486. And he's the one that goes and fights against the Greeks and tries to take over the territory up in Greece. He had some success, but some considerable failure. He's the one that went up and took Athens and went on and was defeated at the Battle of Marathon. Now that was Darius Hystaspes, see? If you know anything about secular history and Greek history, you know where this fitted in. Well then, when he died, his son Xerxes came to the throne. Xerxes came to the throne in 486, and Xerxes was determined to take Greece. And he was defeated at the Battle of Salamis. And he was very upset about being defeated at Battle of Salamis. As a matter of fact, that was the high level watermark of the Persians trying to take Greece. They took Athens, went on to Marathon, were defeated at Marathon, then later Xerxes was defeated at Salamis, and they moved back. And after that, 100 years after that, Alexander the Great took them over. But Xerxes had a fine temper. He was a bad temper. He was just very upset about that. He had a real ego thing. And if you read your secular history, you find that he did everything to take Greece, but he couldn't conquer Greece. And he came back in a real mean mood. You know what happened when that mean mood? he had his wife Vashti come in to show her off to the princes of the kingdom. And she said, "You're not going to use me. I'm not going to be your beauty queen. I'm not going to be Miss Persia. I refuse." She stomped her little slipper down and went back into her room. And he said, "We're going to get another queen, because if this gets to be known, then we're going to have a women's lib problem that you've never seen throughout the whole of the Persian Empire." And he looked around, and who did he find? Esther. Okay, I'm trying to relate this to the kings of Persia, see? So that, and then after that, the last king that we have are concerned with was Ahasuerus. He was also called Longomanus, which in Latin means long hands. And he's a piano player. Artaxerxes Longomanus comes in. So these are the five kings, and right now we're during the time of Cambyses, and things actually stop. The work is suspended in verse 24. Now, we move into 520 B.C., and in 520 B.C., we've got a new king on the throne, and this new king is Darius Hystaspes. He's been on the throne for 2 years. The time is now ripe to get back into the building of the temple. And here come the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. You'll find in Haggai and Zechariah, by the way, references to the time, to the period of history, the dates, actually, when they prophesy in December and so on. Very fine time reference. So, from in chapter 5, we have the actual completion of the temple. Actually, pardon me, chapters 5 and 6, the completion of the temple. But you'll notice it starts with Haggai and Zechariah. I like these two prophets, because these were men who stood up and say, "Let's not take this sitting down, let's get on with the work." And you could have found 1,000 people that could have listed all the problems and the reasons why they shouldn't be building, but let's be thankful for a Haggai and Zechariah that come along and tell them why they should be building. Haggai's message, by the way, particularly concerned the importance of building the temple. Haggai's message particularly concerned the importance of building a temple. What he's saying in effect is, if we don't have a temple, we're saying we don't have a great God. Now, we had this before in our studies when we were talking about Solomon's temple. We don't do things that way today. We don't say that if you don't have a big church with glass windows and stained windows, you don't have a good religion, you don't have... I mean, a lot of people do that, but I don't think we do that. And the reason is that from the day of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit has made His temple in the bodies of all believers. We're in a different era now, a different age. But at that time, it was important that there be a temple in Jerusalem. It said something about the commitment of the people. And it said something about the power of their God. It was a visual aid, and we were then in the days of great visual aids. So the temple was a visual aid that had special significance, and Haggai was very concerned about building the temple. Zechariah was concerned about the times of the Gentiles. And although we often think of the 12 chapters of the book of Daniel as being a key prophetic section of the Old Testament, you find a lot more detail about the times of the Gentiles in Zechariah than you do in Daniel. I commend to you the study of Zechariah. There are 14 chapters in Zechariah, and it is loaded with information. Very important. The interesting thing is that in Zechariah 12 and 13 and 14, you've got the future of Israel when Messiah comes and inhabits Jerusalem and what he does in the final days, the eschatological building of Jerusalem. And as you read in Zechariah 12, 13, and 14 and see the significance that Zechariah was shown, the significance of Jerusalem in the last days, be reminded that he wrote it at a time when the temple was in a state of on hold and it wasn't being built. And actually his message was, let's build this temple. And so they get into it, and they have opposition again. It's interesting that the opposition doesn't come until God's people start to do something. You just sit down and Satan doesn't care. You start to move and Satan gets up too and he starts to move. It's just a knee-jerk reaction sort of thing. Verse 3, Tatnai. He's the satrap. He's the governor of all the area on that side of the river, of the Euphrates. And he says in verse 3, "Who's commanded you to build this house to make up this wall? Then said we," this is Tatnai, "unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building?" I want to take your names. It's like a cop coming around and saying, "Give me your name. I want your name. I'm going to, you know, we're going to charge you with this. I want to know who that is building that thing. We're going to send a report back on you." Now, this is typical of Ezra's reaction. "But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius." So then Tatnai sends this letter to Darius. And you've got Tatnai's letter in verses 7 to 17. All the rest of the chapter is Tatnai's letter to Darius. And he gives a very thorough report. He's a good administrator. In verse 9, he said, "We asked them what their names were." Verse 10, "We asked them what their names were. And here's what they said." And you've got to give it to Tatnai. At least he recorded accurately what they said about themselves. So if you want a Persian governor's report on what the Jews of that day saw about themselves, what their self-image was, you've got it right in here. It's a beautiful statement. He says, here's what they said about themselves. They said, "We're servants of the God of heaven and earth, and built the house that was builded these many years ago, which a great king in Israel builded and set up." You wouldn't know him, but he's Solomon, you know. "But after that, our fathers had provoked the God of heaven. He sent Nebuchadnezzar." See, they know their history. They know what was going on. They knew where they were. "In the first year of Cyrus, he made a decree, send us back. He told us we could bring all these things back. And he said in verse 15, let the house of God be builded. And then came Sheshbazzar and laid the foundation." And verse 17, "Now therefore," this is Tatnai's conclusion, "let there be search made in the king's treasure house," this is Darius now, "which is at Babylon, whether it be so that a decree was made." Let's check out and see if a decree was really made. And so this word gets over there in chapter 6. We can be very thankful for Darius, this great Persian king, because he went to his archives and he found there the roll at the end of verse 2, and thereon was a record thus written. And here we have, right back to square one, we've got the record of Darius's decree that they should go back. You'll notice what it says in verse 4, "Let the expenses be given out of the king's house." And in verse 6, he's, "Now therefore, Tatnai, governor beyond the river, your companions, let the work of this house of God alone. You stop hassling them. Moreover, I make a decree that you're to help them, and they're to use all of the tax money that they want to build this temple." This reminds me a little bit of when the Israelites came out of Egypt. Remember, they worked for 400 years, they hadn't got paid, and he said, "You ask for gold and silver," and they asked gold and silver. They came out loaded with bracelets and all kinds of stuff coming out. So when God does something and takes his people out, he supplies their needs as well. And he did this from these sources. Well, it was an exciting time. Verse 13, Tatnai hears all this, and it says, "So they did speedily. The elders of the Jews built it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah." So let's remember that it was because of the faith and courage and concern of two men, enabled by the Spirit of God to give them a vision of destiny, of where they were. Zechariah gives them a vision of destiny as to what Jerusalem is going to be, what God has for the Jews in the times of the Gentiles. And then he says, "Look, if this is our destiny, if this was what God has for us, let's get down and build that temple." In other words, these two prophets, especially Zechariah, were helping them to see over the horizon. And I think this is a note that we need to strike in our thinking and our meditations and our speaking, that we would encourage our brothers and sisters to look over the horizon, to see the destiny that God has down there, and then to bring our lives and our work and our commitment into line with it. And so the temple is finished. In verse 15, this is the year 516 B.C. The 70 years could be calculated from 586 to 516. In other words, the 70 years could be considered the time in which they were, which the temple was not in operation. The 70 years could also be calculated from 606 B.C. when Jerusalem more or less lost its independence, down to 536 when they were back into Jerusalem. So it could be, shall we say, from a civil or political perspective, or it can be from a religious, the temple perspective. But in either case, you're involved with 70 years. They restore the Passover, and things are going well, and we end up at the end of chapter 6 with the temple in operation. And that now is in 516 B.C. Between chapters 6 and 7, we have the book of Esther. In chapter 7, as we'll see in our next class, we begin with Ezra's return personally with his small band of people, now 58 years later, to beautify the temple. And that's another story. Chapter 7 begins the second big half of the book, in which Ezra himself comes back in 458 B.C. to Jerusalem. Ezra had been with the exiles that remained in Babylon at the time that Zerubbabel and Joshua had led the some 47,000-48,000 people back. And now, years later, with another sovereign on the throne of Persia, he wants to come back. The reason he wants to come back is not to build a temple. That was dedicated in 516. But as he says, to beautify the temple in chapter 7, verse 27, to beautify the temple. And once again, the Persian government is behind him. They provide all that he needs. And we can just praise God for the way that he intervened to give these people great favor with the Persians. There are actually three decrees involved. They're mentioned on that. They're noted on that chart of the various governments and so on. The first decree was the decree of Cyrus, which was to return to the land and build the city. Decree number one was in 538 B.C., and that was to go back and build the city and the temple, for that matter. The second decree was the decree of Artaxerxes in 458 for Ezra to go back and beautify the temple. That's the second decree. And the third decree was in 444, also by Artaxerxes Longimanus, and that decree was for Nehemiah to build the walls. So just keep in mind those three decrees. 538 was the decree of Cyrus the Great, and that was to return and build a city. 458, Artaxerxes, for Ezra to go back and beautify the temple, and 444 for Nehemiah to go build a wall. So we find Ezra coming back. This is now eyewitness news. He is actually on the scene, and if he could be enthusiastic about what happened a couple of generations before him when Zerubbabel went back, you can imagine how excited he is when he gets to make the trip himself. And given his involvement, his motivation, his excitement back there by the Canal Kibar back in Tel Aviv, you can imagine how anxious he was to actually go himself and see this temple and do something about it. And so the great time comes in chapter 7 when he goes. You'll notice in verse 6, Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. He's writing this now. He says, you know, this guy, he's a ready scribe. This is his own self-recommendation, which is all right, what he was excited about. Verse 7, Levite singers. At the end of verse 9, according to the good hand of his God upon him, for Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. That's not a bad job description for a Christian leader, for a pastor, for a teacher. That was what he was living for. That's what his whole life was about. And he moves on over there. Just in passing, I'd like to draw your attention to something that you might want to study a little bit further yourself. And that is the fact that they brought back treasures from Babylon with them. And in verse 16, we find the treasure mentioned, to all the silver and gold that thou canst find in all the province of Babylon with the freewill offerings of the people. Now keep that in mind, because in chapter 8, we're going to see how carefully that treasure was brought over. And Artaxerxes was very much behind this. Verse 21, he says, I make a decree to all the treasures that are beyond the river that whatever this fellow wants, you give it to him. Gave him a blank check on the Persian treasury to accomplish all he wanted to. And I like verse 23. He really had a theological understanding that Pharaoh didn't have, as we saw before. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done. That sounds almost like the Lord's Prayer. Let God's will be done in earth. And so he moves on over there, and Ezra is very thankful for it. Verses 27 to 28, he says, "Blessed be the Lord God of our fathers, who's put such a thing as this into the king's heart to beautify the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem." And so he's praising God in verses 27 and 28. First part of chapter 8, we find who's coming with him. And by the way, he gets partway there, or gets ready to leave, rather, and finds that he doesn't have enough Levites with him, so he has to go back and draft a few Levites to go. He doesn't want to go without these special people for obvious reasons. The end of the chapter, the last part of the chapter, is interesting because it shows a real act of faith on his part. Verse 21, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava." This is partway on the journey, just before they left the main part of Babylon. Actually Persia, "that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all of our substance." In other words, what he's saying is we're deep in prayer. We're really giving ourselves to God because we want him to send us on the right way. We want to be on the right way so that we'll be protected. Now that ties into the next verse. Because of verse 21, he could say what he said in verse 22. "I was ashamed to ask the king of Persia for a security guard." He said, "I could have had the whole army, but I didn't want to say, give us protection, give us a contingent of soldiers. After all, if God can't do it, you know, the Persians can't do it either." And so we besought the God for this, and he was entreated of us. He listened to us. And so with all of the dangers, you see, they had a lot of treasure. They had millions of shekels worth of gold and silver and all of this. And here was this little defenseless band of people. And they could have asked for the whole Persian army to go with them. But he says, "I was ashamed to ask that because I thought God could take care of this." But you'll notice he could only do that after what he did in verse 21. And then in the most of the rest of the chapter, you have this treasure given to these priests to carry very, very carefully. And this is something you can study on your own, those verses that emphasize the care that they were to take with their responsibility of that treasure to get it back safely to Jerusalem. I think there's a real parallel here in the treasure that he's put in us, the gospel. 2 Corinthians 4:7. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. We're carrying a treasure as they carried a treasure back, and we're responsible for the protection of this treasure and for the right delivery of it. They arrive back in Jerusalem in verse 31. And it says at the end of the verse, "He delivered us from the hand of the enemy and of such as lay in wait by the way." So there was real danger. He wasn't just paranoid. There was real danger, but God got them through. And finally they get back to Jerusalem. Everything is fine. Gets his work done, presumably. Chapter 9, the dark cloud comes over the horizon. And somebody comes and tells him that there are some of the people in verse 1 of chapter 9 who have not separated themselves from the people of the land. Can you imagine his reaction when he heard this? Had there been a time in history before when they'd entered the land and the people had not separated themselves from the people of the land? Had there been a bad result from it? Had it led to idolatry? Had it led to apostasy? Had it eventually led to their being taken off the land? It had eventually led to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in it. Can you imagine how panic-stricken he was? I wish we had just hours to go through his reaction. But verse 3, "When he heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off my hair of my head and of my beard and sat down astonied." In the old King James Version. He really had a reaction. And I think that one of our needs these days is to have that kind of reaction to sin. We definitely need that kind of reaction to sin. And if we're going to see God's hand work on behalf of people, and if we're going to see God's work go forward, I think it begins with that kind of reaction, horror, so to speak, actually at sin. And verse 4, "Everyone that trembled at the words of God of Israel assembled to him." That's important, to tremble at the words of the God of Israel. Then he prays. The rest of that chapter, he's praying. Just notice verse 6. "Oh my God, I'm ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up to the heavens. Verse 10, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments. Verse 14, shall we again break thy commandments? He was very conscious of what had happened the first time. In verse 15, O Lord God of Israel, thou art righteous. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. Notice the abject confession of sin. Now this parallels Nehemiah's prayer in Nehemiah chapter 1. Neither Ezra nor Nehemiah were men who had personally sinned, but they realized the seriousness of any sin in the camp. And so they identified themselves with this sin and led the group in confession. They modeled it. They took the stand on it. They led the group in this confession. And then, of course, there's a good reaction on the part of the people. In chapter 10, they're willing to have action taken, and the action has to be divorce. You say, well, wasn't this a heartbreaking experience to break up homes? I thought God was in favor of the family. I thought he was against divorce and so on. Well, in this particular case, and I don't think this is a model for individual situations today by any means, but in this particular case, in this context, at that point of history, when the nation Israel had gone into the land under Joshua, intermarried with the people, precipitated the times of the judges, and eventually precipitated the idolatry that took them off of the land, and then came back and then started the same sequence again, there was only one answer for it. The family was important, but purity and separation to the God of Israel was infinitely more important. It wasn't the marriage in itself that was the problem. It was what the marriage led to in terms of worshiping another god. And this is a terrible decision, but it was necessary for this divorcing to take place in order that the purity of the people might be maintained. The stakes were too high in this situation. Now, in the book of Nehemiah, we find this great administrator, almost parallel to Daniel, a great administrator in the Persian government. His name was Nehemiah. He's called the king's cupbearer, but he's really an aide. In terms of contemporary government, he'd be somebody like Meese or one of these men in the White House, one of these men who is very close to the president. This man was very close to the king, to Ahasuerus. And he's moving along in his job, and he had it made. He didn't have to really take any action. He didn't have to go back to Jerusalem. He was one of the exiles. He's doing very well for himself. He's walking well with God. But word comes back to him that the walls of Jerusalem are broken down. I don't think this is the result of any invasion or any particular attack or siege of Jerusalem, so much as it was that there was just a deterioration. Perhaps they'd never been really built up in the first place as they should have been. And before we go farther, I must remind us that walls had a very special significance in the ancient world. You hear references to walled villages and unwalled villages. There's a great distinction. If you had no walls around a center of population, village, town, whatever you want to call it, if you had no walls, you were totally vulnerable to attack. In effect, you had no guarantee of your integrity or independence. An unwalled village was at the mercy of anybody that wanted to walk in and take it over. In other words, it was incapable of defense. You had no line of defense. Now, all of this is before the Chinese discovered gunpowder in 1300, you know. Gunpowder changed all this. That's, you know, it changed feudalism in Europe for the same reason. But if you had a wall around, you were in effect saying, we are a city-state. We are a state. We are a political entity. And we intend to defend ourselves. So the wall really was equivalent to, typical of, independence, sovereignty, if you please. So as long as there were no walls around Jerusalem, it was just one more city, and the Samaritans could walk in or out of it, the Edomites could walk in or out of it, anybody could walk in or out of it, and it was totally vulnerable. It had nothing special about it. And so keep this in mind, because when Nehemiah was concerned about the walls, he was concerned about the integrity of this city, the independence, if you please, of this city, the sovereignty of this city. And when he came back to build the walls, it caused a great negative reaction in Samaria, because they then perceived it as Jerusalem and the Jews who were there as being independent. You might say, well, they didn't build a wall all around Judea. No, they don't have to. They would build a wall around Jerusalem, and the core of the people could maintain themselves in there, and if they weren't overcome with siege or whatever, they would be in a position to maintain their integrity, their sovereignty as a nation, and eventually, if they were sieged, then they couldn't, and the people couldn't take the city, then they could move back to their farms and so on. So it was something like in feudal England and Europe, it was like the keep almost, in which you had the absolute place of defense, except this was the wall around the city. So he was concerned. It was a reproach, as we see in verse 3. The reproach, the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, the gates thereof are burned with fire. This probably referred back to Nebuchadnezzar's breaking down the walls and burning it with fire. It had never been fully restored. And it began to hit Nehemiah that this was an important thing that hadn't been done. Once again, he could have stayed in his safe position over there in Shushan, but he didn't. And what's he do about it? The first thing he does about it is pray. And this is one of the great prayers of the Bible in verses 5 to 9. He prays, and he starts with confession. Why are the walls not built up? Why are they in this state? Why are we in reproach? There must be sin. You'll notice again in verse 8 how Nehemiah, years after the exile, a couple of generations after the exile, still has that bottom line to his thinking that was, as we might say, almost etched into the hearts of all Israelites at that time. That statement of Moses, God through Moses, if you transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. If you turn to me, verse 9, I will gather you from hence. That's just like E equals MC squared. I mean, that is the very basis of all of the theology of the Old Testament in terms of Israel, as far as Israel is concerned. If you obey me, you'll be in the land. If you don't obey me, you'll be out of the land. And Israel, in or out of the land, is like a thermometer of history. It's just a gauge on all of history. And it still is today. When I say in or out of the land, I mean in walking with God, in belief, and especially after the monarchy was established with a king of the line of David on the throne. And so he recognizes the seriousness of their walk with God. It would determine their right to the land. Now let me just remind us that before the Babylonian exile, they weren't so worried about this because they kept saying, it'll never happen here. God will never take us off the land. It's like saying, I am never going to get sick. But when you get sick, you don't say it quite so forcefully. You're a little bit more sensitive to it. Well, maybe I could get sick. All right, now they've been taken off the land for 70 years and only a little minority had come back. And now they're not quite so proud about it. And now they're very conscious of the fact it could happen once, it could happen again. So their consciences are very tender on this matter, and especially Nehemiah's. In chapter 2, he comes in before the king to do his regular work. And I think it's a testimony to who he is, what he's like, when the king notices. He says, you're not smiling today, Nehemiah. What's the problem? He says, you've never been sad in my presence before. What a testimony. How would you like to work at an office downtown, or work at a place, or pastor a church, or be a Christian ed director, or a wife or a husband, or a son or a daughter? That's getting too close to home. The people that you live or work with would say, I don't think I've ever seen you sad before. There must be something seriously wrong. Well, I guess Nehemiah invented the smile face because they noticed when there was a difference. He says, this is sorrow of heart. He says, I was very afraid. Maybe he thinks I'm plotting to kill him or something. You know, they're very tender on that. Well, he tells them the problem. And he says, well, what do you want me to do about it? Verse 4. For what dost thou make request? So I pray to the God of heaven. Lord, what will I ask him for? That was one of those fast prayers, you know. But he had a long prayer in chapter 1. And he says, listen, he says, what I really like you to do, O king, is to send me back to Judah unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. That is, build the walls around the city. He says, fine, go ahead. The queen's sitting there with him. I wonder if the queen didn't kind of nudge Ahasuerus and say, hey, why don't you do it for him? Go ahead. Yeah, I have a feeling that if he had never been sorrowful before in the presence of the king or queen, that must have had a positive effect on him, on them. They must have liked him. So he sends him back. He goes on back there in verse 11, so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Now he's an administrator, and he needs to know what to do. And the first thing to do is to evaluate, to make an observation, to assess your situation, and to find out what you need to do. And he was going to do an inductive study of the needs of Jerusalem. So he didn't consult the reference section. He didn't look at the history books. He didn't ask the architects their opinion. He just gets on an old donkey one night in the moonlight and walks around and trots around Jerusalem. That must have been a very, very interesting scene. This great administrator, a Jew from Persia, back to the great city of Jerusalem. The moonlight slanting over all the broken down stones. And the little temple out there on Mount Moriah, on that flat area on the east side of the city. And he gets on this donkey, and clippity-cloppity-cloppity-clop. The donkey probably never opened his eyes all night. And just around that city, and he makes notes. We need a door, we need a gate here, we need some walls here, we need this here. And he does all of this, all of his own. And then he comes to the people in verse 17. He says, you see the distress that we're in? He says, come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. In verse 18, they said, let us rise up and build. Now that's unusual. Notice the effect Nehemiah has on people. He had a very positive effect on the king of Persia. He had a very positive effect on these people. He said, we can do it. Let's rise up and build. Let's do it. They said, all right, let's do it. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. They saw that it was a good work. I think an administrator, whatever level, whatever situation, has to communicate to the people that he wants to do something, that the work is important, that they can do it, and that their contribution will have significance and meaning. And I think that's what comes through when it says they strengthened their hands to do this good work. They got the message. This was a good thing to do. They could do it. They're responsible to do it, and it was a privilege to do it. So you can just get the excitement of the atmosphere here already. And by the way, they did it in 52 days and nights. They worked day and night, 24 hours, right around the clock, and they did it in 52 days. Chapter 3 gives us the listing of who has responsibility for what. Talk about an administrator. He figured out exactly who should work on every brick, every stone, every gate, every doorway, every lintel. He plotted the whole thing out. And he had the thing so well organized that they did it in 52 days. Well, if that's all the word of the story, we could identify with it so far, but we'd say that's okay for Nehemiah. But see, when I do something like that, when I try to start a program, it never works because there's always so much opposition. So we can thank God for the opposition that starts in chapter 4. The opposition runs through from 4 to 6. Now, let's just see what some of these levels of opposition were. Okay, first of all, there was scorn. And 4, 1 to 6. Scorn. Sanballat. You know who Sanballat was? He was the governor of Samaria. Now that's not the old city of Samaria. This is now called the area of Samaria. This is the area north of Judah. There's a good map in Leon Wood to show you the areas at that time. And of course Sanballat saw this as a threat. He was a Horonite. That is, he came from Beth Horon, you remember? And he scorns them, and he mocked them. And he says, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? They're going to do it in a day? That's called argumentum ad absurdum, I think. Nobody ever said they're going to do it in a day. It's going to take them 51 more days in a day. But will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Are they going to do something here? You can't do it, is the message. You can't do it. Forget it. You can't do it. Do you ever have anybody say to you, you can't do it, it can't be done, we've never done it this way before? No, this is what he faced, scorn. What was his response? The asterisk indicate responses here. What was his response? prayer. Verses 4 and 5, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn the reproach on their own head. Give them for a prey in the land of captivity. Cover not their iniquity." He doesn't like them very much. He says, "They've provoked thee to anger before the builders." So he says, "Now, Lord," he says, "you know they're making fun of us. You know that they don't know what it's all about. They don't know which ends up. They've got their problems. Lord, let them stew in their own juice and encourage us while we go on and get the job done." All right. "So we built the wall." The end of the verse, "For the people had a mind to work." Why did they have a mind to work? Well, obviously God had intervened in their hearts, but I do want to reinforce the concept that God used a leader like Nehemiah, who was a man of prayer, who was the right man in the right place at the right time, and he used him with his courage to galvanize these people into action. And sometimes in our contemporary philosophy and ethos, we get the idea that leadership is a bad thing. We say, "Well, I don't think we need leadership. My opinion is as good as somebody else's opinion. We're all equal." We have a sort of a pseudo-egalitarianism in which we think we shouldn't have leaders. Nobody should lay anything on me. I ought to just be able to do my own thing. We're all leaders. You know, we're all leaders. We're all God's people. And like the sons of Korah said, "You take too much on yourself," you know? Well, the history of God's dealing with people is not that there are first-class citizens who are leaders and second-class citizens who are followers, but rather that he designs that some would take the responsibility of leadership. Leadership is never easy. You think, "Well, if I can only give the commands, it would be easy." Listen, I don't know of many situations in which it's not much easier to be a follower and not have to make decisions than to be a leader in which you have to make the decisions. You get in the pastorate, and you'll find it's a lot easier just to come to church at 11 o'clock Sunday morning and open your Bible and open your hymn book and sing the hymns and shake the guy's hand and go out the door and say, "Well, I enjoyed it." All week, he may not have enjoyed it. It's a heavy thing to have that responsibility. And in order to take that leadership responsibility, there needs to be a love for God in which you're willing to let him lay a burden on you, and a love for people. Now, if it becomes an ego trip, you're in trouble. But leadership, biblically based, is not an ego trip. It's a heavy responsibility. It's work. It's in many cases suffering. And you need a sense of responsibility for it. And I really believe that that's why these people had a mind to work, because there was a leader who had a mind to get the job done. And he was used in that situation. All right, the second one is force. Verses 7 to 8, they threatened them. Sanballat and Tobiah, these men, they were very wroth. And verse 8, they conspired all of them together to come to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. So here's force, all right? We can't frighten you away with scorn. We're going to come in here and beat up on you. So what did he do? What was the response? Prayer, verse 9. "We made our prayer to God and set a watch against them day and night because of them." Beautiful combination of faith and works, isn't it? We prayed to God. Just say, "All right, God, take care of them." No, they didn't. They prayed to God and they got out their swords. They took the precautions. And so day and night they set a watch against them and they prayed to God. Setting a watch against them without prayer would have been futile. Praying without doing what they could would also have been futile. All right, the third line of attack is actually not from the outside, but internal problems. Internal problems. And these internal problems, actually, this should be 410 to 519, I'm sorry. 410 to 519. And there are three lines of internal problems. Now Satan starts to go for the inside. This happens in a church situation. It happens in any kind of a situation. He'll attack from the outside, and just about the time you get your defenses all aimed to the outside and can stand against them from the outside, all of a sudden something will happen behind your back on the inside. It's very contemporary, you know. And the first thing is they were discouraged. They said, "There's much rubbish. The strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed." They got tired of carrying out the stones and the rubble. "There's much rubbish. So that we are not able to build a wall." Discouragement. They were discouraged. You got to clear out all of this rubble before you can build. Well, we can't start to build before we clear that out, and we're tired just clearing that out. Oh, Nehemiah, we're not going to make it. We're just tired, you know. We're dead tired. We got these notebooks to do and these papers and these exams and so on. Nehemiah, I've been called Pharaoh, but never Nehemiah. The next one was fear. The next one is fear. And they're afraid of their adversaries. And their response is down in, I'll give you all of those, you can see all of those responses. In verse 13, notice verse 13. The first one is identification of the leader with the people. When they're afraid, what does a leader do? Come on, you guys, don't be afraid. No. Verse 13, therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall and on the higher places, I even set the people after their families with their swords and with their spears, and I looked up and rose up and said to the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people. It seems that he identifies with them, he gets in there with them, and he personally puts them in the right position. And then in verse 14, he encourages them. He says, be not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight. Their strength was in the Lord. He never tells them that they can do it by themselves. He simply reminds them that they've got a God that can do it. Remember how great God is. And then the third one is division of responsibility, verses 16 to 23. He had half of the servants work at one time, half of the workers work, and the other half keep guard, and then he spelled them off so that throughout the rest of this, they worked very, very hard. And I like the little touch at the end of verse 23. None of us put off our clothes. In other words, we kept working all the way through, except that everyone put them off for washing. Can you imagine the sweat in working in Jerusalem? And this would be summertime, because it would be early summer. He came over in March. And he paid attention to detail. He even kept them on with clean clothes. Somebody had to do the washing. Chapter 5, most of the chapter gives us another very sad kind of internal problem, greed. Some of the Jews who came back had gotten rich off the others. And they laid burdens on them. They'd gotten themselves, some of them had gotten themselves into debt. And to pay off their debts, they had to go bankrupt. And when you went bankrupt in those days, they didn't just pay so many agora on the shekel or something like that. But they actually took you into slavery, and you had to work it off. But you could never work it all off, so you're just a slave for the rest of your life. So there were rich Jews, and there were poor Jews. There were slave Jews. And there had been a fair amount of graft and so on. And Nehemiah found out about this. And his response to that was to be an example himself. In verses 14 to 18, he took care of people who were in debt to him and so on. And he challenged them on that. And he says, listen, we're all in this together. We can't have people who are slaves, Jews who are slaves to other Jews. And then in verse 19, prayer again. Think upon me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. Think on me for good. I'm sure if Moses could hear him where he was at that moment, he'd say, amen, Nehemiah. Go to it. The next line of attack, the last one, is craft. And this, again, is from the outside. This is chapter 6. These guys, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, Gishmu, his other name. They came in verse 2 and they said, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. I was up in the plain of Sharon, up toward the Mediterranean Sea. Nice country down there. He says, let's go to a neutral place. Let's go to a retreat center. Go to the Ono Hilton, and we'll have a seminar on this. We'll sit down and just talk this all over. Well, Nehemiah's pretty sharp. He says, they thought to do me mischief. I knew what was going on with them. And I sent messages unto them. Notice the personal involvement, the excitement here. He says, I sent messages to them saying, I'm doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? I'm doing a great work and I can't come down. Now that doesn't mean down socially, but he means anything from Jerusalem was down. And of course it was down in altitude as well. But I'm not going to go down on the plane over there by the Mediterranean Sea and go down and have a talk with you. What can be gained by that? I'm doing a great work. I can't come down. Now, there are all kinds of applications to this, but I think one of the most obvious and one of the most practical is that as you go along in your ministries, wherever it is, whatever it is, if the Lord is using you at all, if you're moving ahead in it at all, you will have all kinds of invitations to get involved on all kinds of committees and all kinds of involvements, of boards and whatnot. And you could just be a full-time committee member. It doesn't pay too well usually, but you could be a full-time committee member. And I don't want to put down committees because I think committees are a smart idea. But there's a matter of priorities. And in this particular case, when they're on a 52-day countdown to build these walls, he didn't have time to go down to discuss the issue. But there's something even farther on than that in his thinking. What was there to discuss? What was there to discuss? What was their angle? What did they want to talk about? What was their agenda? Their agenda wasn't who's going to pay for it or how big is it going to be or what color you're going to paint it. What was their agenda? You shouldn't be doing it at all. Beware of any group that you might get called in as a consultant with. They might pay your hotel expenses and pay your plane fare. But make sure that the agenda isn't really, should we be doing this at all, if it's something you know that God wants you to do. There was nothing to discuss as far as he was concerned. Well, you can see all kinds of implications to this. And so the first one was deception, and the response to it is right priority. Right priority. The second one is a threat. In verses 6 and 7, we don't have time to read them in detail, but the response is in verse 9, prayer again. Now, therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Strengthen my hands. My hands are only pieces of flesh with bone in them, unless you strengthen them. And of course, not just in a literal sense, but in a whole spiritual sense as well, God had to be his strength. And then the last one was actually treachery in verses 10 and 11. It said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come and slay thee. They try to frighten them. In the night they will come and slay thee. He says, listen, you got to shut up the doors of the temple. He said, they're going to kill you. And he says, should such a man as I flee? That's a good statement. Should such a man as I flee? Nehemiah had no illusions as to his superior fighting ability. But what he means is, should such a man as I am in God flee? You remember that passage back in Joshua when they had failed to take Ai because of Achan's sin? And you remember how Joshua said that it's a terrible thing to see Israel turn its back to the Lord. And this is somewhat of the same thing. And so the response to this was courage in verses 11 and 12. Verse 12, lo, I perceive that God had not sent him, but this was just a subterfuge, it was just treachery. And in verse 14, he prays. Well, this is the series. As I have just seen them in outline, you might have other ideas on it, but it just seemed to me that these were at least four of the main kind of attacks that were leveled against Nehemiah when he's trying to build these walls. Verse 15, can you believe it? The wall was finished in 52 days. It was finished in September. He had left in March from Shushan. He'd come over there, got the thing organized, got it all done. He was finished in 6 months from the time he left his work in Persia. Notice at the end of verse 16, they perceive that this work was wrought of God. Now, in chapter 7, we begin a new section of the book. As you can see in your outline, the first seven chapters really have to do with constructing the wall. And beginning at chapter 7 or 7 verse 5, if you want to fine-tune it, we find what I would call reconstituting the nation. The walls were broken down and needed to be built up. He got that done in the first seven chapters. Now, from 8 to 13, the people had a need, and he's reconstituting the nation. He's actually going to have to revive it, as we'll see, and many wonderful things happen. The first thing that was done is that he had to give the control of Jerusalem to somebody, so that he gives it to his brother, but not just because he's his brother in verse 2, but because he's a faithful man and feared God above many. Verse 2, he carefully explains that even though he's his brother, as an administrator, Nehemiah has to give it to somebody who's qualified as well. Verse 4 describes a situation which is just about unique in history. The city was large and great, but the people were few therein, and the houses were not builded. So they needed a population. We're going to find out where they get the population in chapter 11. Well, in the rest of chapter 7, we have the list of the people now who are in the land. You will notice that there's a parallel in many of these things between Ezra and Nehemiah. Each gives the situation, each gives the decree to get them over there to work. In both Ezra and Nehemiah, you have the listing of the people involved. In both Ezra and Nehemiah, you have a moral failure and you have action taken and so on. Chapter 8 is one of the great chapters of these historical books. This is just before the wall is completed, actually. All the people gathered themselves together as one man in the street that was before the water gate, and Ezra the scribe, they spake to Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses. And they brought the book out, and here is the great reading of the scripture. You wonder what they've been doing for devotions all this time. They just didn't read the Bible. They just didn't know what it says. And when they found out what it said, it excited them and transformed them, just as it did in the days of Josiah and Hezekiah. Verse 5, he opened the book in the sight of all the people. Apparently, a lot of people, either that or Ezra wasn't too tall, because in verse 4 it says he stood on a pulpit. That's not a pulpit like our pulpit. He stood up on a little box. So this is soapbox preaching. He gets up on top of a box. They can see him. And verse 5, it's a good thing he was on that, because at the end of verse 5, all the people stood up. So verse 8, he reads of the book of the law distinctly and gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. Why? What was the book written in up to this point? Hebrew. What language did they speak? Aramaic. Very good. So he did a running translation from Hebrew to Aramaic with them. And there was a tremendous response to this. And notice verse 14, they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded Moses, that they're supposed to have a feast of tabernacles in the seventh month. They said, hey, we didn't know about that. We're glad we read that. Hey, it's just time for that, isn't it? Hey, let's go ahead and have it. What month is it? That's now. We're right on time. And so they go ahead and have it. And then in chapter 9, the more they knew of the word of God, the more they repented of their sin. The children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloth, and earth was upon them. Uh-oh, we've got the same problem again. The seed of Israel separated themselves from all strangers and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of others. They read the book and confessed. There was confession by the Levites and others right through this whole chapter. Chapter 10, we find the listings of some of the people that took part. In chapter 11, they've got to decide who lives in Jerusalem. And even in those days, apparently, people didn't want to live in cities too much. Some of them had to. But here's one of the few times in history where you've got planned urbanization. Planned urbanization. So they cast lots, and every tenth person had to go live in Jerusalem. How about that? And the thing I'd like to point out before we end is that as Nehemiah goes back to Persia, back to Shushan, back to his work, after the dedication of the walls, in which you can read the great description in chapter 12, he comes back and he finds that again the people had not separated themselves. And I just want to outline chapter 13 and three main problems that he found when he came back for a second time to Jerusalem. Verse 10, the portion of the Levites had been not given to them. What's the portion of the Levites? What's a five-letter word for that? Tithe. You ever heard a passage in the Old Testament talking about tithes? bring all Malachi, that's Malachi lived at the same time. Malachi fits right in here. He says, bring all your tithes into the storehouse. So Malachi fits right in here. And the first problem they had was they hadn't paid their tithes. In verse 15, the second one was they were working on the Sabbath. They're making wine on the Sabbath. And the third thing they did wrong, that's verse 15 on, 23, you'll never guess it, intermarriage again. They had taken some wives of these other people. And verse 25, still always the man that's shocked with sin, like Ezra was, I contended with them. And then this these men in opposition get after him again, Sanballat and so on. Verse 28, I chased them from me. Notice the personal involvement, how he hates sin. I chased them from me. Verse 30, then cleansed I them from all the strangers. And he ends up, he leaves his case with God. He says, Lord, I don't know whether I've done a good job or not, but remember me, O God, for good. So if you don't get excited by the book of Nehemiah, then you ask him to tell you about it when you get to heaven. But I think as we read this scripture, we can see enough of this first-person eyewitness involvement as a model of an administrator who worked under the power of God to get an excellent job done.